From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, Sacramento's poets celebrate the first 30 years of their Poetry Center with a new anthology. And Quick Fast, two local journalists give up something different each week, research it and write about it. But first, many serious fast-spreading diseases that sicken and kill humans start in animals, like birds, pigs, and apes. Examples of those diseases include influenza, HIV, SARS, and Ebola. In hopes of preventing future pandemics, UC Davis has launched an international program to find and control diseases that cross the species line. This global early warning system is called PREDICT. The scientist at UC Davis who's leading this effort is Jonna Mazay. She's professor of epidemiology and wildlife health and director of the Wildlife Health Center in the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Jonna Mazay, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for having me.
How do serious diseases cross from wildlife to humans?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting question. About 60% of all the diseases that we get as humans come from animals. And most of the ones that come from animals actually first start in wildlife. So they're wild viruses that are evolving along with our wild species. And then they can spill over into people. And they can do that directly by spilling over when people are working in areas where wild animals are or living in areas where wild animals are or rodents, you know, the plague. Plague is a famous one where rodents were in houses and their fleas bit the rodents and then jumped off and bit the people. So they can spill over directly into people, or they can spill first into livestock, which is very common. And we see that with things like avian flu spill into poultry, and then people get exposed by interacting with the livestock.
If a human has the flu and you cough on someone, there's a good chance that person will get the flu. Does it work that way with animals and humans?
It can. It can very much so, but it depends on the virus. So the scary thing about flu, when we're dealing with H1N1 now, and the scary thing about avian flu and H5N1, is that flus can evolve very quickly. So they remix with pieces of other viruses that are carried by people. So when you cough on your dog, for instance, people say, how come my dog doesn't get sick? Well, your dog may well have gotten the flu from you, but the dog may not cough. They may have different symptoms than you do.
Jonna Mazay is a professor at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, and she's leading the new global early warning pandemic system called PREDICT. Let's talk a little bit more about some of these diseases that cross from animals to humans. You mentioned flu, but there's some others that are some of the most dreaded sounding diseases
Yes.
of recent years.
Yes. Yeah, so we I think many people ask me, oh, you're an epidemiologist. What's that? Do you work on skin? A lot of people ask me. And really, epidemiologists are those people that work on diseases in populations. And the easiest way for me to explain that is to talk about Ebola, because people remember that movie Outbreak where, you know, you saw the people storming in the big white suits with the hood. So those are epidemiologists, but we tend to be a little less glamorous, mostly behind our computer screens or in our laboratories. But yeah, so we think about HIV spilling from chimpanzees actually into people, probably again through the bushmeat trade. So as I mentioned, sometimes people hunt or eat bush meat, wildlife that is killed for meat, and then can have devastating consequences like Ebola and HIV. So we worry about diseases that we don't know what diseases are out there. So we have this daunting task to try and find the unknown before it spills out and makes a pandemic.
Well, if you don't know what these diseases are and they are found in animals that are in every part of the world,
right,
how on earth do you set about identifying and preventing these future pandemics?
Yeah, so we're disease hunters now, the CSI, if you will, of the world, or some people call us virus hunters. And we're out there looking at these hot interfaces. So where the animals and the people are coming together in particularly areas where we have high biodiversity, high population density, human population density, and then the environmental conditions that are ripe for this kind of transfer of disease. So some of those places we're looking at are obviously Southeast Asia, where most people have heard about the avian flu being important. Africa, the Congo Basin, where HIV and Ebola is, you know, really thought to have originated. And then other places like South Asia, India, Bangladesh, again, you have that warm temperature, really drastic changes in land use that sort of put the ecological systems out of balance. And then the same thing is happening in the Amazon basin. So we have our target regions, and then we put on our detective hats and go into those hot interfaces.
Those target regions are huge.
Yes. Yes. So we have to be very smart about it. We have to be very targeted. And we're looking at places, for instance, there's a new transcontinental highway going from Brazil to Peru. So that will be changing the land use, changing the migration patterns of animals as well as people. And that gives us a clue as to where we should be looking. I also work in the Rift Valley in Africa, and we're seeing desertification. So rivers are drying because we're diverting them for agriculture and because of climate variability. And when the rivers dry, we see animals and people, wildlife, livestock, and people all coming together to very small watering holes where they're drinking and bathing and using the same water for washing. So that's one of those hot interfaces. So we know where to look, and then we have molecular and sophisticated diagnostic techniques to try and identify the related suspects to those pathogens we know have already spilled, and also brand new ones.
You mentioned as examples of the hot interfaces, the Amazon, South Asia, Africa. What about here?
I mean,
it gets pretty hot here.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people living in California and a lot of wildlife, I guess.
Yes. So we are funded by the United States Agency for International Development. And that's a development organization that's working to build capacity and help do good things in countries that are dealing with economic development. So we have the $75 million award to go out and work in those regions, but we're lucky to be partnering with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the CDC here in the U.S. that's doing the same thing.
Well, on the one hand, $75 million sounds like a lot of money relative to the typical grant that a professor gets. On the other hand, given the scale of the problem and the size of the areas that you're working in, it's almost nothing.
Absolutely. And that's, again, if you were to say, we're going to go to all those regions and test all the wildlife in all of those regions for these diseases. And it's expensive to do the testing when you don't know specifically what you're looking for. You're looking at families of viruses instead of for a very specific thing that may already have a diagnostic test developed. It does sound like a lot of money, but again, you can't just go and blanket test everywhere. So you have to be very targeted and pick those regions and those countries that you're going to work in very carefully.
I guess you have or will have a lot of partners in those countries.
Yes. Yeah, so we work directly with the local governments and nonprofit organizations in those countries. And we're doing that primarily through some of our partners that actually have headquarters in this country. So that includes the Wildlife Conservation Society, Wildlife Trust. Those are both New York-based organizations. Global Viral Forecasting Incorporated, which is a San Francisco organization, and then the Smithsonian Institution out of DC.
Are you going to be spending much time in the hot interfaces like South Asia and Africa?
Probably. I go a few times a year already, and I've made a deal with my family. They know I can. I'm going to have to go a little more frequently. So hopefully that's part of it on a personal level, bringing my teenagers to learn about these things and to help the world too.
Like, how much of your year will you be spending in these places?
Well, I think I'll probably go at least once every couple months.
Jonna Mazet is Professor of Epidemiology and Wildlife Health and Director of the Wildlife Health Center in the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She's leading the new global early warning pandemic system called PREDICT. She is leading this thing. It's based at UC Davis, but it's going to involve people working in many parts of the world, including South Asia, Africa, and the Amazon, where diseases can spread from animals into humans and sometimes even turn into a worldwide pandemic. Let's say you're in an area that's one of these hot interfaces. What do you do? When you get off the plane, what do you do next?
Well, luckily, we have partnerships already established in all of these regions. So we're already working with groups to help them make their plans on how they do surveillance. And that includes doing surveillance, watching hospitals and clinics to see what's going on, what's the baseline level of disease that's going on in these places. But when we get there, we're targeting on the wildlife side of that. And so
You're looking for sick animals.
We are looking for sick animals, but I know it's sounds even more complicated. But often these pathogens, these disease-causing organisms, cause diseases in people, but not in the animal host. And so what we're doing is we're working on a couple different levels. We do what we call syndromic surveillance. So that's when the animals have clinical signs of disease that we know are similar to those that spill over into people. We do look for sick animals, but we also look at dead animals. They're kind of our best early surveillance system because we can do a lot more testing with those dead ones. So ones that get hit by a car or have died because of disease or are hunted. And then we also sample and track live healthy animals to see where they're going. So for instance, with SARS, healthy animals at the markets in China had the SARS virus, but those animals actually came from Southeast Asia. So we track them back to their source and then look in the healthy populations as well.
Well, let's say you're in one of these places and there is a mysterious pattern of dead animals showing up and there's a mysterious illness showing up in people who live in the same area.
Right.
What do you do then?
Right. So then we work with the World Health Organization and some of our other partners, and we work on both sides, taking the same tests from both the animals and the people, comparing them, looking to see if we're seeing remixing of the strains that are going on. And then we need to immediately put in protective measures to keep it from spreading farther.
How did you manage to get $75 million for this?
Well, I think that number was based on what the USAID knew was being spent on avian flu, and thinking about how, if we're now moving from testing wild birds and looking at wild bird changing patterns for avian flu, what we needed to do to go even more broadly to try and find that next HIV before it became worldwide distribution. So they actually made the estimate on the dollars, and then we put together our system of what we could do with that. And as you say, you can't go everywhere and do everything with that amount of money, but we think we can make a really excellent start.
I learned an interesting word in connection with this, but I don't know if I know how to pronounce it, but I'm sure you do. It's the word for animal to human diseases.
Yes, so zoonotic disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, it looks like zoonoses.
Yeah, so zoonoses is the plural. So, yeah, so not the noses at the zoo, but yes, diseases that go between people and animals, they can go both ways, right? So with swine flu, we're talking about H1N1. We're talking about people having it, even though it had pieces of DNA from swine and avian flu, and then giving it to their pigs. So we have a couple different places where that's occurred now and been documented. And so that's where we then see it can remix again. But yes, so zoonoses is an interesting word, but zoo just means animal. So that's just the way it works.
Well, it sounds like maybe the animals need their own research project to stop diseases going from us to them.
Yeah, they do, actually. And that's one of the things we're really excited about, that the U.S. government had the opportunity to give this program to many different other research organizations and universities. And they chose our One Health Consortium, which is a group of conservation-oriented organizations. So we know, instead of just going in and shooting a bunch of bats and rodents and testing them in areas where they might give diseases to people, we're going to do it very conservation-oriented way without killing animals for the most part. We won't be killing any animals to sample them. So we're very excited to be working on this, but we also feel like it's building on our conservation ethic at UC Davis and with our partners, as well as our long history of working on diseases that are impacted by the environment and are shared by people and animals.
And finally, Jonna Mazay, it seems to me that pandemics are happening more often. Is that true, or is it just that we're hearing more about them in this never-ending news cycle?
No, I think there's good evidence that it is true that pandemics are increasing, and that's another reason why the U.S. government is making such a big investment, is that it's not if the next pandemic's going to happen. I think most people believe it's when. And so if we can minimize it to the extent possible, I think we'll be ahead of the game. We have all the technology to do that, but we have to commit to it. So certainly I think the land use changes, us just traveling all over the world, and then our demand for goods from all over the world is really making the perfect storm.
Well, on behalf of the human race and all the animals on Earth, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Joanna Mazzi, Professor of Epidemiology and Wildlife Health and Director of the Wildlife Health Center in the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She's leading the new global early warning pandemic system called PREDICT. Joanna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, imagine fasting every week and choosing something different each time. That's what two local journalists are doing. You'll meet them when we come back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is on Facebook. Find us at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, national unemployment rises to nearly 10% despite other positive news from the economy. Where are jobs going to come from and when? Plus, an opinion poll finds almost 4 out of 10 parents don't think the H1N1 vaccine is either safe or needed for their children. Parents' rights and public health coming up on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Imagine fasting every week and giving up something different each time. Two local journalists are doing that. In the process, they research the thing they're giving up and write about it on their blog, Quick Fast. They're Melody Stone and Aaron Tracy, and newspaper readers in Woodland will know their names. They are reporters at the Woodland Daily Democrat. Melody, Aaron, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Melody, what have you given up for this week?
Cursing, profanities, foul language.
Oh, my goodness. Did you do a lot of that before?
Well, we're journalists, and newsrooms, I don't know about, probably not so much in radio because you guys aren't allowed to curse on the air, but...
And we're awfully nice here at Public Radio.
Yes, yes. Public Radio is very nice, but we tend to have a lot of curse, or co-workers that tend to curse, and I didn't curse too much before I became a journalist, but my vocabulary quickly went down.
What about you, Aaron? Was cursing something you did a lot of before you started fasting?
Well, I think I use it for punctuation. I think I've learned so far this week that sometimes I find it hard to express myself without the use of curse words, but I'm also realizing that it's not totally necessary and it's important to explore other ways to express yourself.
And what does that mean to give up curse words and vulgar language? You can't use the words, of course, not only because you're fasting, but also because this is a radio station. But how do you work around that? Are there some gray area words in language that you're not sure whether they count as curse words or vulgar language?
Definitely. And that's something that we've learned. We've been, what is this, our fifth week with fasting something different. And we've learned that we need to talk about, we need to have a contract signed at the beginning to decide what constitute curse words or, you know, each week what the rules and regulations of our fasting should be. So there's definitely been gray area in the cursing as well. And we decided later on dirty jokes should be included in it. And
that they, meaning that they, you can't tell them or you can tell them.
We can't tell can't dirty tell jokes them. This week.
I see.
So we won't be telling any on the air for all your listeners that just tuned in to hear dirty jokes.
What about old-fashioned curse words? I mean, for some people, they're old-fashioned words like damn or even heck.
Oh, yeah. Not the D word that yes. you just said. We will yes. not say that. We're not sending anything to hell this week.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Nothing is going there.
But euphemisms like heck, because heck is an old euphemism for hell.
Yeah, we're okay with that.
We're okay with euphemisms. We basically decided that, now heck is a little bit on the... Because if I heard a child saying heck, I think it'd be cute. I wouldn't be uncomfortable with it. But when I hear a child curse, I am uncomfortable. It kind of like, ew, it doesn't sit well.
Right.
Or if for a lot of body parts, if a doctor wouldn't use that term to describe a body part, we're not going to use it. So those are kind of been our guidelines for this week. If it would make us feel uncomfortable if we heard a child say it or if a doctor wouldn't use it.
Right.
My guests are Melody Stone and Aaron Tracy. They're the writers of the blog Quick Fast. They fast from something for a week and then research it and write about it. So Aaron, has it been harder than you thought to give up cursing?
Definitely. I cursed on the way here, I'll have to admit it.
Really?
In the car, angry at the driver in front of me. So it has been difficult.
So you broke the fast?
Yes. Well, we've both broke the fast. In fact, we haven't gone a week without breaking the fast. But I mean, I think the whole idea is to be mindful of what we're doing and really realize how much in this particular week, how much we curse and, you know, maybe find alternatives to that.
Last week, you gave up sugar.
Right? Added sugars.
Added sugars. Yeah, because that meant that natural sugars and things like orange juice were okay.
Right. If it's just orange juice. Right. Yes.
What about artificial sweeteners?
We decided to just avoid that on our own because we found them distasteful.
Yeah.
And we didn't feel like, I think we both agreed that we didn't need them. So I used agave syrup in my coffee, which is a completely natural sweetener. And Aaron switched to tea.
Was there anything that you were about to eat and then you went, oh my goodness, this has sugar in it?
Yes, I was at a empty bowls function and drinking or eating soup. And then they had cookies and I was about to reach for one. And oh, right, can't do that.
But I also read that pizza was an issue.
Yes, yes. Our coworker brought back pizza and we had to say no because there is marinara sauce and marinara sauce has sugar in it. And I actually did choose at a restaurant, chose a pizza that did not have marinara sauce so that I would avoid breaking the fast. But the very next day they brought in pizza to work and they were like, don't you want some? And we're like, no, no, we don't.
Melody Stone and Erin Tracy are authors of the blog Quick Fast. What about your significant others? Are they affected by this? Does it annoy them?
I don't think it annoys them. I think they think it's funny and they try to get us, like this week, try to get us to swear. The first week we did complaining.
Oh, they tried to get you to swear?
Right.
Oh, my
husband did that the first day I came home with a fast. He set me up and I managed to break the fast. I think that was the first time I broke the fast was
right.
he tricked me into breaking it. And then for the first fast, he actually wanted to fast with me. Because it was the complaining fast. We tried to go a whole week without complaining. And he lasted maybe a little less than 12 hours.
Really?
And then he was going on a complaining tangent. And I just sat there quietly. And he's like, why aren't you talking to me? And I'm like, you're complaining. I can't talk back.
Don't participate in that.
But there are negative things happen in life. And sometimes we have to discuss them. How do you discuss negative things during that week without complaining about them?
Well, and I think that that was something that we learned. We interviewed a mental health professional for Yolo County, and she said that it's more about healthy venting, and it's important that we do complain. And I think we found ourselves...
It's important that you complain.
Yes. So, I mean, in this, I think it was a lesson of moderation, that some people just complain just to complain, and... Melody
raised her hand there. You also wrote in the blog about someone else, a minister somewhere who had written about complaining.
Yeah, we researched, and so I was researching it, and there's a minister who challenged his congregation to fast from complaining. And actually, in the process of blogging and Twittering about complaining, an old junior high teacher of mine said that she's been fasting from complaining for 13 years now and she's so happy. And so there are people that have made it their life mission to cut out griping and complaining from their talk, from their speech. I think that Aaron and I are probably not going to go down that path, since as soon as the fast broke, we were
back
to complaining. Because as coworkers, if you've ever had coworkers, you know that a big source of conversation with your coworkers tends to be complaining.
Oh, yes. Another thing you gave up for a week was breaking the law. Now, people see you too. They think what two upstanding young women you are. Mm-hmm. How would you be breaking the law?
Well, we found it nearly impossible not to break the law. There's so many ridiculous laws. I mean, we were good. We set our cruise controls. We used our blinkers. We tried to stop before the line. You know, all the obvious ones. But there's some that we learned, like chasing squirrels and birds in the park in Sacramento.
I didn't chase squirrels and birds in the park the entire week.
No, she
but
didn't.
That is illegal to do that in Sacramento.
Really?
Yeah.
And another odd thing that's illegal in Sacramento involves a bicycle.
Right.
Well, that's in Woodland. Is this the
there are two things. Yeah, there's a kickstand in Woodland.
Yes, there's a kickstand in Woodland.
You have to, in other words, you have to have a kickstand on your bicycle in Woodland.
And I actually interviewed a police officer who has pulled people over for not having a kickstand on their bike.
Now, in Sacramento, it involves K Street.
Right. Yes, you can't ride your bike on K Street in Sacramento. I was very put out by this. I live in Sacramento and I ride my bike a lot.
But I've seen cops and people like that riding their bikes down K Street.
Exactly.
I guess you're going to have to take it up with the cops.
And in this case, you know, we realize that people use it as a tool so they can pull people over. And I mean, maybe we wouldn't get pulled over because we don't look like we're up to no good. But
like bicycle profiling.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And actually, the SNR, I mean, we're following up on a lot of these facts because Sacramento News and Review just published a story about police officers pulling over bicyclists with fixed gears because they don't have handlebar brakes. And apparently that's illegal, which I didn't know. And I've been riding a fixed gear the whole week. So I broke that law.
And also on the law breaking, Melody, you posted about your husband. You had to intervene to stop him breaking the law on a car trip.
Oh, no, no. He broke the law on the car trip.
Oh, he did break the law,
because we were going all the way up to Humboldt County. We're both from Humboldt State. She grew up in Davis, but we both went to Humboldt State University, so we have a lot of connections back there. And in order to get to where we wanted to go in a reasonable time, he drove so that I would not be breaking the law. He sped all the way there at a good, 75 miles an hour.
Melody Stone, Erin Tracy, they're authors of the blog Quick Fast. Erin, how do you choose what you're going to give up?
Well, we're trying to each week do something, 1 week physical and then 1 week mental, so that we're not abstaining from sugar and then gluten. And, it's that's difficult. So we get a break from each thing. I don't know. We just talk about it the week before. I think next week, what are we doing?
Caffeine,
right. So we're going back to the physical.
Because being aware of what you're saying for me is, I find, very draining. And while I was kind of craving sugar a lot and maybe sluggish at first and a little bit grouchy, towards the end of the week it was actually very fine. But the mentally checking yourself every time you open your mouth to speak is very draining. And so we can't do that every week. So I'm actually like kind of looking forward to being able to run my mouth and not worry about what I say, although I should always be concerned about what I say because that gets me in trouble sometimes. But I'm very looking forward to just knowing that I can't have coffee, I can't have chocolate, I can't have soda, and that's just, I'll drink my herbal tea for a week. And
but we also don't want to have food fasts every week because then our body would probably not react well.
Are you still glad you're doing this?
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. We have our blog. We also do a weekly column in the Daily Democrat. And it's fun just interviewing the professionals about it, too, and seeing what other people think, and also getting the reaction of our family members and those around us. And
it also makes doing those things so much sweeter when we're done.
Right.
I bet.
I still get a thrill about going 5 miles over the speed limit. I get special joy in griping about something very juicy and gripeable. Today I had a scone at Fox and Goose, and I was just so happy because that was one of the things I had to turn down over my fast. I went to Fox and Goose with my in-laws, and apparently that Devonshire cream has almost a pound of powdered sugar in it, and I could not eat it. And so today I was like, oh, so happy, even though I've been off that fast for a while now.
We appreciate those things, but I think we're also learning that these are all things that are non-essential and, we can do without. And so maybe we should moderate them a little bit more.
Erin's been doing really good about not upping her sugar intake.
Melody Stone, Erin Tracy, they're both reporters at the Woodland Daily Democrat and authors of the blog Quick Fast. They fast from something for a week and then research it and write about it. This week, they're abstaining from all kinds of curse words and vulgar language. Last week, it was sugar. And we'll have a link to their blog, Quick Fast, at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Melody Stone, Erin Tracy, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, some of the poets at the Sacramento Poetry Center, they're celebrating their 30th anniversary. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Coming up this week, singer-songwriter Tori Sparks is coming back to town. She'll join us Friday with a new song. Also, an album version of Five Course Love, the musical by Sacramento composer Greg Coffin, is about to be released. On the next Sound Advice on Thursday, opera with Sean Bianco. And tomorrow, my guests include the man who made the Sundance Award-winning documentary Fuel. Josh Tickell grew up among the refineries of Louisiana. His film is about America's reliance on oil. Today's a big day for Sacramento poets. Not only is it Sacramento Poetry Day, it's also the day when the Sacramento Poetry Center celebrates its 30th anniversary. A big part of the celebration is a new anniversary anthology, Keeping the Flame. A little later, you'll meet two longtime members of the Poetry Center, including the anthology's editor. But we start with the woman who founded the Sacramento Poetry Center way back in 1979, Teresa Vinciguerra. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me.
Well, now, this is back in the days before Craigslist, Google. How did you find these other poets who wanted to get together?
Well, actually, it started with a small ad in the Bee. In the want ads, I asked for local poets to come join me, possibly future members of the board, because I was thinking actually of starting a nonprofit organization at the time. I knew nothing about what was going on in Sacramento. I was actually new to the area. I had gone to UC Davis, graduated from there. I was a transplant from Southern California and didn't really know anything about the local poetry scene.
Well, what did the local poets think about this newcomer putting an ad in the paper and saying, hey, poets, get together?
Well, in the very early days, I didn't get much response from organizations who were already started in the area. I just got a response from a professor, Catherine Holvine, at Sac State. I got a response from a couple of other local poets, and we just gathered in someone's house and talked about it.
But weren't there other poetry groups in Sacramento at the time?
Yes, there was the Chaparral Poets. There were poetry organizations in Folsom. There was one actually in West Sacramento. So there were little poetry organizations that were meeting in people's living rooms. And of course, there were poetry organizations tied to the university and tied to Sac State. But I wanted something that was more community-based and open to everyone.
And did it turn out that way?
Yes, it did. With the help of several people who came to the meetings, because we needed at least three people to sign the Articles of Incorporation, and I got together some money. I think at the time it cost $200 to incorporate. So we wrote up the articles, and there it was started. We had our first reading in a Victorian downtown. It was very successful with C.B. Davis and Catherine Holvine. I think we raised about $500, and that was our seed money, and we started the organization that way.
Well, it's one thing to be a poet who wants to get together with other poets, but then there's a reality of running a nonprofit organization. What was that like?
Well, that was part headache and part joy. I got together with several people, Mary Zeppa and Pat Grizzell.
Who will be on a little later.
Yes. We started Poet News, which is now Poetry Now. But Poet News was a small four-page rag, and that pretty much got out the word. Because as you say, at that time, there was no internet. So we got out the word that there were going to be local readings, something standard happening, you know, once a month with local poets. And so we had Poet News, we started the readings, and we had a small grant actually from the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission of about $300. So we started with very little money.
Today's Sacramento Poetry Day, and the Sacramento Poetry Center is celebrating its 30th anniversary, in part with a new anthology called Keeping the Flame. My guest is Teresa Vinciguerra, who actually started the Poetry Center back in 1979. You left the center just a few years later.
Well, not a few years. We started in 1979. I left in 1985, basically to raise my family, and actually stayed on behind the scenes till 1986, till Landing Signals, the first anthology that was published by the Poetry Center, was published. Because I worked very closely with Victoria Dahlke at the time. We were the administrators of the project to see it through financially.
And Victoria Dahlke is the arts correspondent for the Sacramento Bee.
Yes, she is also a very accomplished poet.
And she was involved in providing poems to our Capital Public Radio's old program guide, the KXPR program guide, way back in the day.
Yes, she was. And in fact, I have a copy of the guide right here to show you. And one of my poems in the inside cover. So it was a nice contribution to the poet scene at that time done by KXPR.
You are a professional writer, but you don't earn your living from poetry. It's a more prosaic form of writing.
Yes, I'm actually a technical writer in the healthcare industry.
Must be very different to wear these two hats, to be a technical writer and to be a poet?
Yes. It's the right and left brain going on all the time in my head. I actually do have a notebook that I keep at work, however, if poems come through my head or some phrases come through my head, jot them down.
Do you write many poems nowadays?
Probably two or three. I was just joking with Mary and Pat before I came on. I probably do about two or three a year because most of my poems are long and it takes me a while to craft them to where I want them.
What do you think now when you look at the Sacramento Poetry Center, which has been going now for 30 years, has got a new anthology out? Would you have been surprised if you'd known back in 1979 when you put that little ad in the Bee that it would still be around in 2009?
Well, that was my dream, Jeffrey. I wanted something that would last beyond me. I wanted something that the community could be proud of and could continue on its own. I didn't want something just started by me and ended by me if I left. I wanted it to go on. And making it a nonprofit available to go for funding, either through the Sacramento Arts Council or through the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission, and to attract volunteers, this is really what I wanted. And I'm so overjoyed that it's lasted this long. And hopefully on and on.
And you've got a poem, one of your poems, for us. What is it?
Yes, I do. There were a lot of projects that the Poetry Center was involved with on the sidelines, and one of them was the production of a calendar. I think we did it for 3 years in a row that helped to fund a nonprofit organization for the disabled. I think this particular calendar funded the blind in Sacramento. And I'll read it. It's actually a children's poem, which is, I write very few children's poems. It's called Recipe for Whatchamacallit. A twist of this, a taste of that, a juicy slice of chitter-chat. A little of here, a bit of there, a saucy shake of Worcestershire. A spot of pink, a gram of blue, a rousing splash of rinky-doo. A dash of sweet, a pucker of bitter, a pinch or two of silly critters. A barrel of sass, a smidgen of laws, a carousel of wry guffaws. A pound to give, an ounce of take, a hearty wish on birthday cake. And don't forget a special spaghetti, the kind that unfurls a wondrous confetti. Now mix and pour and rattle and shake, use every bit, make no mistake, for life is short, a flash in the pan, so laugh and cry, do all that you can. Taste, enjoy, each whatchamacallit, you're the cook, the bake, the chef, the wit, cooking time is fast, bam, lickety-split.
That's great. The poem, Recipe for Whatchamacallit, written by its author, Teresa Vinciguerra, poet and founder of the Sacramento Poetry Center, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, two more longtime poet members of the Sacramento Poetry Center. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. The Sacramento Poetry Center is celebrating its 30th anniversary with a new anthology called Keeping the Flame, the First 30 Years. You've already met one of our guests, Teresa Vinciguerra, who founded the Sacramento Poetry Center. With me now are two other people who've been with the Poetry Center for a long time, including Patrick Grizel, who was part of that founding group, and Mary Zappa, who joined a couple of years after it started, and she is editor-in-chief of the anthology. Mary, Patrick, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good
now,
to be here.
Now, Mary, ironically, the Poetry Center's anthology doesn't have poems in it.
No, that's right. It's Keepers of the Flame, the first 30 years of the Sacramento Poetry Center is, I've been calling it an in-print highlight reel. It just wasn't possible to do justice to a history that long in depth. But this has pictures and essays by nine of the people who were also a big part of the history, and an interview with Teresa, and just an attempt to give people some good glimpses into all the many wonderful things that have happened over the 30 years.
Patrick Grizel, how active is Sacramento's poetry scene? I know there are a lot of people who write poetry and who are members of the Poetry Center, but, you know, compared to other cities of comparable size, how big a poetry scene is there in Sacramento?
Well, I think it's very big these days. You know, there was a point when there were really no real organizations for poetry in Sacramento, very few reading series, very few publications, you know, a series of chapbooks or anything going on. Nowadays, there are at least five, six or more really vibrant poetry series going on, lots of publishing going on, including, you know, what is called, I guess, desktop publishing now. Lots of chapbooks published all the time. It's really active. You could probably find a reading every night
every
in Sacramento
night.
When you might be lucky to have found one a month, you know, if not that long ago, really.
Mary, I was shocked when I read something that the Sacramento Poetry Center has produced more than 1,000 shows.
I think that's probably true. Over 30 years, we've had, in the last few years, we've had readings just about every Monday night. And we've always had at least two a month for over 30 years, plus conferences and special readings on the weekends and things during the week sometimes. I think that's probably true. It sounds like a lot, but I think it's an accurate number.
Patrick, are there certain kinds of poetry that are favored or not favored at the Sacramento Poetry Center? I mean, if you show up, if you're a rap-style poet or you're a cowboy poet, for example, or you write in very perfect rhyming meter or not.
Well, I do all of those things.
And superbly, I might add.
You're welcome.
He's not joking.
No, kidding. Yes, I mean, I think the Poetry Center has always been inclusive of, you know, any types of poetry, you know, and have featured, you know, many different styles of poetry. It used to be that, you know, you would show up at an open reading and you could read anything you want and people would enjoy it or not enjoy it, you know, or you know, whatever. But I think now, instead of just showing up to read at an open mic, I think people who represent different kinds of poetry are actually being invited and being featured at the center, which is a good thing. And I think part of what Teresa wanted to do and that we all wanted to do in those early days, to really be inclusive and not become just sort of another clique and just a small group of poets who like to get together and hear themselves talk.
Now, Teresa read one of her poems a little while ago. Would like to hear a poem from each of you two as well, Mary Zeppa and Patrick Grizel. Mary, what do you have for us?
I'm going to read a short poem called Blessing What's Yet to Be Lost. I need to clarify one thing for you. I use the word amygdala, and it's a part of the brain which is located deep in the medial temporal lobe of the brain, and research tells us that's where deep emotional memories are.
Oh, thank you.
And it's called Blessing What's Yet to Be Lost. Blessed be the cerebral cortex, its bustle, its chatter, its crowd. Blessed be the amygdala rocking, the curly-haired, dimpled, dead child. Blessed be the spine that will hold us to the task, to the thing that gets done. Blessed be the life she's forgetting, my mother, the obdurate one. Blessed be the strength she remembers. Blessed be the hay bales she tossed. Blessed be the ribcage rasp of the thin. Blessed be our rattling embrace.
What gave you the idea to write a poem about the amygdala and the cerebral cortex? Not it, common words in poems.
I think they're more common than you might think. But it's my mother suffering from some form of dementia. And so I've been thinking a lot about how the brain works, you know, what goes on in there, why are some things saved in your mind and others lost?
Did you write this recently?
Maybe within the last year.
And have you read it to your mother? Is she able to?
Oh God,
to follow?
No. I don't know what she would do. I mean, maybe she would say, "That's nice." She still has all the social skills. I think that's the last thing to go. So she'll say, "What are you planning to do today?" And then 2 minutes later, she'll ask me again. So no, I haven't read anything like that to her.
Mary Zeppa reading her poem, Blessing What's Yet to Be Lost. And Patrick Grizel, what poem do you have for us?
I have a poem that's simply called Poem in D.C. And it's actually a memorial poem for a man I knew who was my next-door neighbor in Washington when I lived there a few years ago. Very active in the community. They called him the mayor of Foggy Bottom, which is the neighborhood we lived in near the Watergate. And one interesting thing about him was that he owned Hugh Hefner's original round Playboy bed. He'd bought it.
Wow.
And so this poem, and it's odd because this is actually a memorial poem for him. Not like most memorial poems. Poem in D.C. in memoriam for Pat Patterson, the mayor of Foggy Bottom. My next-door neighbor owned Hugh Hefner's round bed, the original Playboy bed. It's huge and has ship's lanterns affixed to the circular headboard. He built a circular staircase that led to it in the second-floor bedroom. He even curved the walls of the small bedroom to fit the theme. He bought it at an auction, he said. A lot is all he's willing to say about the price. Just a whim, but it took over. Do you know what happens when you have a bed like this? You get very, very focused.
Oh my goodness! What a wonderful story behind the poem.
Thank you.
Now there's a wide range of poetry there, Jeffrey.
Yes. Now, Mary and Patrick, you both write songs.
Yeah,
or
that's
lyrics,
true.
At least
mm-hmm. that's true.
What's the difference between writing lyrics and poems?
Oh, I think there's a big difference. In my mind, at least, the lyrics are not poems. People can set poems to music, and sometimes that works. But lyrics need their music. They're not, they need it to be effective. Would you agree with that, Pat?
Yeah, and I think you have to at least give a nod to certain restrictions in music that you don't have to so much with poetry, especially with free verse. You limit it somehow with meter. You can rhyme or not rhyme, or at least the song lyrics should sound like they rhyme, even if they don't. And many of my influences as a songwriter are, people who have also sort of been called poets, like mm-hmm. or are poets, like Leonard Cohen or Dylan or Tom Waits or any of those people who are great wordsmiths.
Let's just squeeze in a few seconds of one of Pat's songs. This is How You Been.
I must be walking around in circles. Been down this road. Everybody seems so distant. Everywhere you go.
Now that's a rehearsal recording, and you're playing the guitar and singing.
Yes, with Steve Bird on bass. Steve and I are in a band called Junkyard Burlesque, and it was something we were working out.
Great.
Thanks for playing that. That was a nice surprise.
Very lovely.
Well, that's what we like to do. Back to the poetry. The Sacramento Poetry Center is celebrating its 30th anniversary today with a new anthology called Keeping the Flame, the First 30 Years. The Poetry Center was founded in 1979 by Teresa Vinciguerra, along with Patrick Grizel, who was there right from the beginning. Also from early days, Mary Zappa, who's editor-in-chief of the anthology. Teresa, Patrick, Mary, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Thanks for having us, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having us, Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Miranda Fox. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. At Insight, we have one goal.
That's an interesting... I've never been asked that question before.
Good.
Very good question.
That is such a good question.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That is such a great question.
That's a really good question.
From scientists, lawmakers, artists, interesting people of every stripe.
Well, you have really uncorked Pandora's box with that with that question.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.